All right. Well, welcome to a little bit late live virtual True Consequences and Cause of Death crossover. I'm your host, Eric Carter-Lundin, and my lovely co-host here is Miss Jackie Moranti, who you may know from the Negligent series, from Damien Herrera, from
Holly White. Sarah Beard.
She's written a lot.
Yeah.
She's written a lot, and she's written more that's going to be coming out soon as well. So welcome, Jackie.
Well, thank you.
How are you tonight?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well. I see you've got your lovely Cause of Death shirt on.
Cause of Death shirt. Yeah. Cause of Death.
Nice. And I've got my Humanized True Crime shirt on, which is available. Hers is available.
Available on TeePublic.
Yeah. TeePublic. Mine's available at TrueConsequences.com. Mm-hmm. And we are super excited to be here tonight. We're going to talk a little bit about crime, which is a surprise for people who listen to Jackie, probably. But for people who listen to me, it's probably not a surprise that we're going to talk about crime. We've been talking about doing this for a while.
About a year. Mm-hmm. We've been kind of kicking the idea around.
Yeah.
And we had some different sort of flows with it. And we finally ended up here.
Yeah. So, yeah. Super exciting. We're so glad that you all could join us. It looks like we're still waiting on a few more people. Oh, there comes another one. Hopefully not... everybody else will be hopefully not that late, but you can rewatch this as well. So if you fall asleep because we're boring, or if you get busy because the mailman comes, I don't know what happens in people's houses, but if any of those things happen, you can rewatch the recording, which will be really cool.
I have to give a shout out to my kid.
Yeah.
Hi, Jessica.
Is that it?
That's it.
Okay.
That's all.
Hi, Jessica. We're glad you're here. Hi, Rena. Hey, JT. Hey, Whitney. Who else is here? Ellen. Hey, Ellen. Thanks for wishing or hoping that I feel better. I do feel much better. It's taken, it took a while for me to get fully better. I still have a little weird voice thing happening, but I think it's in my head. Not really in reality, which is how most things normally are. But yeah, I feel better and I'm getting ready to go to England.
That should be exciting for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Crime Con in England. That's going to be amazing.
It'll be good. Yeah. And Jackie is going to try to go to as many tour dates as possible.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Depending on the whole work situation.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, we'll see.
All right, Jackie, I am going to turn it over to you. We're going to get started. We're going to jump into this, and you're going to lead us off here.
Sounds great.
Okay.
All right. So the first thing I'm going to ask is I'm going to ask everyone to hold their questions until after we're finished with the written part. Mm-hmm. And the only reason is we'd like to give a general overview of why crime happens before people start asking too many questions and throwing this kind of off base.
And also, we will have time for questions.
Oh, yes.
So make sure you're ready for those. We want you to interact with us. Even though it's through the chat box, we still can see them and we can still answer them. So, All right, I'll shut up now.
According to the Oxford Dictionary, epidemiology is the branch of medicine that deals with the incidence, distribution, and possible control of diseases and other factors relating to health. So that said, when we talk about a crime epidemic, we have to consider that crime itself isn't a disease. It's a symptom of several other social diseases that we experience.
Which is something that I talk about a lot.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't be surprised to hear this. Contributing factors of crime are socioeconomics, education, generational abuse, familial criminality, drug abuse, and mental illness. And I'm going to begin by discussing some of these contributors. So violent crime consists of five criminal offenses or categories: murder and non-negligent manslaughter, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, and gang violence. And I just need to say this, that I'm super heavily edited whenever you get my podcast in your ears. When I record, it's kind of a disaster most of the time. And Jackie understands because it's the same for her.
It's the same for me.
So I'm going to stumble over my words. I'm going to say things wrong. I'm going to say way more times than any person should ever say and there's another I apologize in advance for that. Okay, so poverty has been consistent in the U.S. throughout history. There have always been the haves and the have-nots. The strain theory states that an individual may be more likely to commit a violent crime when they feel economically or socially alienated from the majority group. People living in poverty feel that they have been alienated from the haves. The strain theory addresses three strains that can lead people to crime. The inability to achieve one's goals, the loss of valuable possessions, and negative treatment by others. All the above topics are causes of strain in people's lives. Many people who live in poverty feel that the only way they can make ends meet is by engaging in criminal activity. And while the U.S. is considered one of the wealthiest countries in the world, our poverty rate has increased over the last 2 years. We see a rise in unsheltered people, especially in warmer climates, to further perpetrate this. There has been unprecedented inflation, and during the pandemic, jobs were scarce. As the poverty rate has increased in the United States, so has violent crime. Next, I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview of the correlation between education and violent crime. I don't know how I even ever record an episode, honestly.
And the thing is like, I wrote this, so you should be like, oh, this is just another thing Jackie wrote.
I know.
That's cool.
So places with high dropout rates often have higher crime rates, including violent crime rates. Areas in the country that have in states where post-secondary education is held in high regard, crime rates are lower than in places with poor education systems. Education is often called the least expensive crime deterrent. And there are several schools of thought on this. One is that kids who graduate from high school have a sense of achievement, so they become goal-oriented. Another is that these kids learn the consequences of their actions, they know right from wrong, and they are less willing to pay for their mistakes, so they'd rather not make them. The third is that they understand that instant gratification isn't always the best thing for them, so they learn patience. They also learn through various subjects that challenges of adult life come up and how to meet these challenges head on. So, again, if you listen to my show, you know I talk a lot about how childhood trauma contributes to the overall, propensity for crime, propensity for reoffending. Unhealed trauma really, I think, is a precursor for a lot of drug use and criminality. Absolutely. And I think it's a huge thing that often gets neglected. And not really dealt with. Mm-hmm. So child neglect can be a precursor to violence. When children are either punished too severely or not punished at all, they find ways to lash out and get the attention that they're lacking. Oftentimes, they lash out violently. Children with parents who are engaged in their growth are less likely to commit crime of any type, which brings me to domestic violence and abuse. When children suffer from domestic abuse, they are more likely to be abusers themselves. That's known. Everybody knows that. But they're also more likely to commit violent crimes against people outside of their immediate family. Children who grow up with abuse in the home aren't taught healthy ways of dealing with conflicts, so they'll more likely turn to the conflict management that they know, violence, or that they were taught, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Or they become like me and they become people pleasers to not have conflict at all. Domestic abuse will follow families for generations, and no one in the generational pattern will know how to deal with conflict in a healthy manner. So the last generation can't go back to the first and ask how they would handle conflict, because they either will just dole out more abuse or won't have a good answer for the question. Kids who grow up in gangs are far more likely to commit violent crimes. They see violence and around them every day, and it's an acceptable way socially for them to resolve conflict. It becomes part of their culture, their way of life. Violence becomes normalized. All right, just want to make sure I'm still good here.
You're still good.
Well, you think so, but it's hard to tell. They often see violence as a means to an end. Someone will do something to them and they take revenge by doing a drive-by or beating that person up. Gang initiations are violent. In order to be accepted, other gang members may beat the person being initiated within an inch of his or her life, and they may ask that they go out and perform a violent act on someone else. Gang families have very strong ties to the gang, and kids from abusive families will see these ties as stronger than the biological ties that they have with their families. Drug abuse is often tied to violent crime. Many offenders have addiction or abuse issues, and most of them have either been drinking or using drugs at the time the crime is being committed. And if you hear a lot of street noise, I apologize. You may not be able to hear it, but there's some people racing down the road right now.
Yeah.
Welcome to Albuquerque.
Welcome to Albuquerque.
Okay, so we're talking about drug abuse and substance abuse. Mm-hmm. And what happens when somebody is under the influence, they're not in a clear and present state of mind, and they can often commit a crime over any perceived slight. And sometimes they may not even remember the act itself, which is kind of like what we saw with Mark Redwine.
Yeah, and exactly. I was just thinking that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It seemed like he had, like you said, some blank spots in his memory, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Huge.
Yeah. Speaking of Mark Redwine, all of this ties into mental health. Those who experience severe mental illness often go untreated. Many of them can't afford medication, which could treat their illness, and a lot go undiagnosed. There are those who don't like the effects that the drugs have on their mental state, or they feel they've been cured after taking the drug for a few months. Then they relapse, but they don't realize that they are relapsing. That is really scary for me because I just got off of my antidepressants.
I'll let you know if you're relapsing.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. If I stop texting, then
that's when it's bad. Yeah.
Because I always be texting.
Oh boy.
Violence is triggered by a combination of these things. Changes can be made, but it takes communities coming together to undo the trends that we're seeing. It also takes money and an investment in people. So, if you watch the interview I did with Brian Cologne, we talk a lot about how there is no easy fix to crime.
Right. There isn't.
Because there's so many layers, like you know, and I have talked about over and over again, there's so many different things that are contributing to it. Sometimes layers of those things are contributing to it. And the solution is not easy.
No, the solution is not easy.
And not cheap.
And not cheap.
Yeah.
And yeah. There's a ton that goes into it. Mm-hmm. So next, I'm going to discuss how crime affects our society and how our outlook affects the crime rate. So our reaction to crime is a major factor in criminal activity, right? Some examples are judicial views, apathy by society, acceptance of criminals and criminal activity, and overcrowding in cities. So if we look back to the murder of Kitty Genovese, she was a woman who lived in New York City. And in 1964, she was coming home from her job at a bar around 3 o'clock in the morning. And she saw a man approach her and she ran for her apartment building. She was only about a block away. The man grabbed her and he began to rape her. Now, one neighbor called down from his apartment window and said, "Leave that girl alone." And the man who was assaulting her let her go. But before Kitty could get into the safety of her apartment, he came back, raped her again, stabbed her several times, and stole her purse. Kitty died in the parking lot of her apartment building. Now, this story has been researched time and time again since 1964, and several witnesses heard the commotion. Kitty fought back. She screamed. She tried to get help, but there was the one neighbor, just one neighbor, who yelled down from his window, and nobody else intervened. So another neighbor of Kitty's actually opened his apartment door to see her attacker stabbing her. But rather than call the police, he called a friend to ask what he should do.
Yeah.
And the friend told him not to get involved. So later, several neighbors would be asked about the murder by the police, and the ones that had witnesses,
I'm not the only one.
No, you're not. Heavily scripted and really edited. Mm-hmm. The ones that had witnessed this said that they didn't want to get involved either. So there were several witnesses to this. Some stories say actually up to 37 people heard Kitty screaming.
Wow.
And only one neighbor yelled down from his window. Nobody called the police. Mm. So this is kind of the same reaction we see today, right?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to get involved. You hear somebody screaming and you just go, that's their business, not mine. And what this is called is crime apathy.
Yeah.
It's bad when it has a name, right? So apathy plays a huge part in our crime rate.
Mm-hmm.
Because if no one says anything, then we're just allowing it to happen.
Right.
So apathetic communities are really a lot less likely to report crime. Either it's mistrust in the police, it's fear of intervening. There's some reason that people, they just don't want to get involved. Mm-hmm. Not my problem. And that is super, it's allowing these things to happen.
Yeah, it's like I say on the show, whatever you ignore, you're permitting to happen.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. If you see something, say something. I mean, that's the tag word for the day, tag phrase for the day, but people still don't.
So I have a little anecdote that may or may not be relevant, but I'm going to talk about it anyway, if you don't mind, for like a few seconds.
Yeah.
Okay. So when I went to CrimeCon, I told you this story, but maybe some of the people that are on here have not heard it yet. I know that Whitney's heard it because she was there and she listened to me freak out about it afterwards. But I was walking back to the hotel because I was staying in a different place, and I heard a woman screaming as I was walking, and this car pulls up and this woman's trying to get out of the car. And she jumps out of the car. The guy grabs her, the driver grabs her by her hair and pulls her back into the car, closes the door, and just starts punching her. And like, I feel like I was the only person that was
paying attention. Yeah.
To that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my immediate thought, like I didn't even have a thought. I picked up my phone and I called 911, and I kind of walked backwards a little bit to see the driver's license plate so that I could give that to the police. And it really shook me up, but I was really proud of the fact that I didn't like get so triggered by it that I didn't do anything,
that
I got
froze.
Like paralyzed,
mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, I don't know whatever happened to that woman, but I feel like at least there was a chance that somebody could intervene. Wasn't going to be me, cause I didn't want to, you know, die.
Exactly.
Which could happen.
Which could happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Personal intervention isn't always the thing to do, but as long as you're calling the police, as long as you're getting help somehow,
yeah,
that's better than doing nothing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Sorry.
That's
okay. Cut you off.
That's okay. Because the next thing is something I'm going to talk about.
It's a good segue.
It's a good segue. Right. So a lot of people now, you'll see them whip out their phones and they'll video whatever's mm-hmm. going on. They're not calling 911. They're videoing whatever disaster is happening before
yeah.
them. And that's just as bad as what happened to Kitty. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as bad. You're not.
It's
almost worse. Yeah. Because now you're documenting somebody else's pain. Why?
Yeah.
Right. So that was my next one. And we're on to our next subject, which is a popular phrase we have now is that crime is everywhere and you can't get away from it.
Yeah.
And so,
especially in Albuquerque.
Well, okay, but we can get away from Albuquerque.
That's true.
Okay. So a question we should ask on this is crime really everywhere? It's not. It's not. And my daughter can attest to that. She probably will later. And a better question yet is, shouldn't we do something about crime being everywhere?
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't we get involved in our communities a little bit better?
Yeah.
So the next thing I want to go on to is law enforcement. Right now, law enforcement is kind of a touchy subject. They're coming under a lot of criticism for a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
But every society needs some kind of law enforcement, right? They need someone to keep people in line, or people are going to step over those lines.
Right.
And I don't want to be law enforcement.
No.
Okay. I do not want to be law enforcement. I don't want to make people follow the rules.
You don't have to.
That's good. That's good. And I don't want to stop violent crime. I mean, I don't want to be in the middle of something violent going on, because I would be totally worthless in that situation.
Yeah.
You know. So the strength of a police force can drive crime. When law enforcement is underpaid, overworked, and constantly being held back from doing their jobs by whatever higher entity there is, the job won't attract the best people.
Mm-hmm.
Police don't have the easiest of jobs. They have to deal with the most horrible situations on a day-to-day basis. And it takes a certain kind of person to be a cop, right? And some are good and some are bad.
Right.
But if they're not happy in their work and they're not getting paid properly, let's edit that out, right?
Yeah.
The ones that could make good cops are going to find higher paying jobs with a lot more job satisfaction.
Absolutely.
So if we have cops that don't care about their job, that's going to drive crime rates up.
That makes sense.
Now, this also leads to a lack of investigative emphasis. And this is something we see a lot
mm-hmm.
on the reservation.
Yeah.
A lot. So crimes that are poorly investigated is what we're talking about. On the reservation, there's so many jurisdictions involved that nothing gets done. And they don't talk to one another, and they don't have a set plan, and nothing gets investigated, and evidence gets ruined, and all kinds of stuff happens on a reservation. And many times the families are left to investigate crimes on their own. And in fact, they're told, call us when you have something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's investigative emphasis. And what that does is it makes criminals believe that, well, no one's going to catch me.
Right.
No one's going to look for me. No one's going to catch me. I'm good to go. I can do whatever.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So the next thing I'm going to talk about is the Stanford Prison Experiment. And you're kind of wondering what this has to do with crime rates, right? So this was an experiment done in 1971 that was intended to replicate prison life. And this experiment was meant to show that people who are living under oppressive conditions will become oppressed, even if the situation isn't real. It was also meant to demonstrate that any one of us could become overwhelmingly evil if we are put into a position of power with anonymity and impunity. Now, it was later found that the PhD that was running this experiment had directed the guards, to be cruel to the prisoners without any retribution. And in fact, if he felt that they weren't cruel enough, he would kind of push them a little bit to be more cruel. So the guards became so abusive to the prisoners that the experiment had to be stopped after 6 days, and it was supposed to be a 2-week experiment.
Wow.
Now, I'm not going to get into what this has to do with prison life, but I am going to talk about how this experiment applies to law enforcement in certain situations. So police forces, I've already said this, police forces across the country have come under extreme scrutiny for the way that people are treated.
Right? Sure.
Yeah. And this isn't without reason.
Yeah.
Okay. There is a feeling that some law enforcement agencies have misused their power, much to the detriment of the people that they are told to serve and protect. And in some cases, they have.
Right. It's not just a feeling.
It's not just a feeling.
Right.
It's evident. So the personalities of these officers kind of come into play here. And this is what it has to do with the Stanford prison experiment. So they're bad cops. We know they're bad mm-hmm. cops. Good cops are bad cops. And they do overstep their boundaries. They do harm to the very people that they're told to protect. And when we go back to the idea that law enforcement isn't paid well, and their job is often thankless, both by superiors and the public, we see that some of the people who work to take a job like that could have ulterior motives of their own.
Right.
Right? So they may be looking for that power over others in order to be happy in that kind of job. They don't care what they get paid.
I think that kind of job does attract somewhat of that, like, stereotypical domestic abuser type personality.
I think that in many cases, yeah.
It can, yeah.
Yeah, it can. I think, and, you know, I mean, what a perfect place.
Right.
You have
power,
all the power, and you're being pushed to have that power. Your superiors are saying, yeah, go out and, you know, get those bad guys
right.
or do whatever. Yeah, sure. So the power alone is going to make them more cruel. And it's going to make them more oppressive, mm-hmm. and it's going to make them way less compassionate.
Absolutely.
So especially when they're given the tools to bring out the original traits that they have to begin with.
Right.
Okay, so just exemplifies everything. So while sorry, there's a street racer going by, so I'm gonna go hanging out
just
for
keep going. Just,
okay. So systemic racism plays a big role in how policing is done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the only thing that makes bad cops bad, right? Some cops are just geared toward aggression.
Right.
Okay, so next we're going to talk about judicial policy. This is a huge factor in violent crime rates. It's known that prisons don't rehabilitate.
Not in this country.
No. All they do is keep offenders segregated from the general public so that they won't offend again. And that's kind of the purpose of a long prison sentence,
mm-hmm.
right? So policy is the policies have changed in the last several decades, allowing offenders shorter prison sentences. For instance, a life sentence in New Mexico is 30 years.
Yep.
After that, the offender's released.
Unless they get multiple life sentences.
They can compile them. But if they get one life sentence, that's 30 years.
Yep.
So another policy that's becoming really popular is the no bond law.
Boo.
And Eric and I talk about this until we're blue in the face. The no bond law is.
Yeah, and we just yell at each other, but we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's like we're screaming at the choir. We're just like, So this policy was intended to kind of even the playing field between more affluent offenders who could afford bond and the offenders who are less affluent who can't afford bond.
Right.
And the intention was to give nonviolent offenders no bond while awaiting trial in jail.
Which sounds like a great idea.
Sounds amazing, doesn't it?
Which is why 86% of the voters in New Mexico voted for that.
Yes.
Sorry, did I steal your thunder?
Okay. No,
okay.
You didn't.
Okay.
But In both of these situations, violent offenders have been released back into the general public while awaiting trial.
Right.
And many of them go out and commit violent offenses while they're awaiting trial.
Some kill people.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll tell my neighbor's story later.
Okay.
So, yeah, there's
that's
that.
A whole thing.
That's a whole thing. That's a whole nother thing.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that most people don't realize is that when you start looking into the no bond laws, this is happening everywhere that they have no bond laws. Mm-hmm. Okay. Violent offenders are being let out because of the Alfred tool, which is this matrix that's supposed to be this wonderful thing that says, this guy isn't violent, so we're going to let him go home.
Arnold.
Oh, the Arnold
tool. Arnold, yeah. But it was an A name.
It was an A name.
Yeah.
It's an Alfred plea. Alfred and an plea, Arnold tool. Yeah. Yeah. Dude, I'm a microbiologist, okay?
That's all right. I've been talking about this more than I want to. So
oh, I know.
That's why it's like in my brain.
I know. Well, I think we both have. We really have been hitting this one hard.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, when you look at bond laws, where you have a bail bondsman who takes the money, blah, 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 blah. If someone's caught on an offense, like they shoplifted a loaf of bread, they were hungry, the judge can actually release them on their own recognizance without bond.
Sure.
There is nothing saying that a judge has to give you bond so that you don't go to jail. So the no bond law is really not, it's not only not effective, but it really doesn't do anything but put more really bad people back out.
Yeah. And, you know, I think Brian Colon talked about that last week on the episode.
He did.
He talked about the fact that when there was bail, even though it was a strain on people in poverty, the family became invested in making sure that that person went to their hearings and went to their probation officer.
Absolutely.
Because they had money invested in it, right? Mm-hmm. Now there's no reason to care.
There's no reason to care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Sorry. Keep
that's
jumping
okay.
in.
That's okay. That's what we're here for. You're the crime guy. I'm just I'm just the epidemiologist.
That's right.
So in 1962, John B. Calhoun presented his research on a population density study. He had been performing experiments using rats and mice since 1946. Hmm. This was a long study. So essentially, he provided several rats with everything they needed: clean bedding, food, water, enrichment, everything. The only thing that they had, they were limited to no predators and no diseases. So the rats thrived during the first year of the experiment. But as the enclosure became overcrowded, the rats began to exhibit more and more antisocial behavior. And they became aggressive towards one another and often violent. Males became hypersexual. Females would neglect the pups they had. They wouldn't build nests. They wouldn't. In fact, they would outwardly cannibalize at birth.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. That's what happens when you have too many animals in a small enclosure. So one subsection of these rats huddled together in the corners and they became antisocial. They only left the corner to go get food and water. And these rats became socially autistic.
Hmm.
Okay. So after the population leveled off and the rats had more space because the weak were killed, basically,
right?
You know, so, and there came a point where they weren't even breeding anymore. Things didn't get better after that, though. The rats still had the aggression. They still had the social autism. They were antisocial. They would still attack one another. Nothing got better.
Wow.
Because they didn't unlearn the habits that they had learned over those years that they were in overcrowded situations. So They remained antisocial creatures, and eventually the entire population of rats died off.
Wow.
Because they didn't know how to socialize anymore. The ones that were the most socially autistic lived the longest, but because they were not socializing right. with anybody, they weren't breeding. So,
wow.
They were the ones that died of old age.
Sure.
And a rat, that's about two. So this experiment showed that population density has a lot to do with violent crime. And we're seeing the same trends now with lower birth rates and higher crime rates. Okay. And we're also seeing a lot more antisocial behavior, a lot more people who don't leave their houses, a lot more people who don't want to be out in
public. You don't have to come for me. I'm sitting right here.
Well, dude, look at me. I'm like staying at home and like I walk my dog. That's it.
I love my house. All my stuff is there.
Right. You know. And besides, I pay for that.
Exactly.
So there it is. So, yeah, we're seeing these trends.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also seeing higher violent crime rates in a lot of the cities simply because of overcrowding.
Sure. And the lack of resources.
And when you see, of course, we live in Albuquerque. And so there's a lot of unsheltered people here.
A lot, yeah.
A lot of unsheltered
people. And it keeps growing.
And it's growing. Yeah. I mean, the weather's warm here. It's a fairly decent place to have to live in a tent if you have to live in a tent.
Yeah.
And we have tent cities
here.
And oftentimes those tent cities are really crowded. They're crowded into parks. They're crowded into sections of town where people are basically living right on top of each other in tents.
Mm-hmm.
And the crime in those communities is very high.
Sure.
Because, well, we go back to
trauma,
we go back to drug abuse, we go back to poverty,
mm-hmm.
and then plus you have all
mental
these people
illness.
Living together, mental illness. Yeah, that's a big one. Then you have people piled on to one another at the same time, and it's a recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge recipe for disaster.
Absolutely.
So the next thing we're going to talk about is that people who live, neighborhoods kind of contribute to violent crime. You always hear about the good side of town and the bad side of town, right? So when you think about crime, we think about staying out of those areas, the bad area of town. And oftentimes it's true, right? I mean, I don't really go to the South Valley very much unless I really, really want some good Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when we think about the bad side of town, you drive through there, you see burned out buildings.
Sorry.
Is this okay?
Okay, we're back.
So we're back. You see burned out buildings, you see empty lots, you see the homeless camps. They're more in that area because they kick them out of the nicer areas. And the entire neighborhood just kind of feels squidgy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the community bonds there are weak. And it's because they don't know who to trust. They can't trust their neighbors, can't trust the police. They can't. All this crime is happening around them and it perpetuates it. To where the community starts to crumble. And so the people there are either based in committing crimes or avoiding them.
Right.
They're not making friends. They're not having social contacts. They're not coming together to is most
it's a lot of fear.
It's a lot of fear. Exactly.
Yeah.
So they stay inside and they try and avoid their neighbors, and all of that sense of community just dwindles. Mm-hmm. And that was my part of it. Your turn.
Well, I want to see if we have any questions from people or if anybody has thoughts that they want to talk about. We're going to get into kind of an open discussion now, but I want to open up to questions first. So if you have any questions, put them in the chat, let us know, or if you have thoughts, or things that maybe were an aha moment for you during this. It's definitely one of those things, like when you hear a politician talk about how crime, they're going to fix crime. And we're going to fix crime by being tougher on criminals.
Right.
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 Which really doesn't do much. And if you look at New York City in the 90s, in the late 90s, early 2000s, mm-hmm. when Rudy Giuliani was the mayor, mm-hmm. Manhattan was, a lot of people described in the 80s, was a cesspool. Mm-hmm. It was where you went for drugs and sex workers and adult video parlors and massage parlors and all mm-hmm. those kinds of things. New York City itself wasn't a place where people actually lived.
Oh no.
I mean, they lived there, but they were poor.
The ones that couldn't live anywhere else lived
right.
there.
Right.
Yeah.
And so Giuliani comes in and creates this whole campaign around fixing the crime problem in New York. And it all sounded great. You know, it really did. And it always does.
It always does.
It always sounds
it
amazing.
Always sounds fantastic.
But he went with this broken window kind of theory around how he was going to structure the police and what they were going to do. And so the idea is that if you just allow even the slightest property crime, like if you're easy on that, then it's going to escalate to murder eventually. So you have to
slippery slope.
Right. Yeah. So you have to set an example. You have to set an example with the people who are committing these petty crimes and like hang them out to dry so that other people are discouraged from, because they're like, oh my God, if this is what they do for a broken window, imagine what they would do if I robbed somebody.
Right.
And that sounded great. But what happened was there became this quota for the police to apprehend a certain number of perpetrators of crime during their beat. And because there was so much pressure from the mayor's office that the lieutenants and captains were putting pressure on the police, and they were saying, like, don't come back here unless you have X number of people arrested.
Oh,
tonight.
So it was the Stanford Prison Experiment.
Essentially,
yeah.
And so you can imagine what happened. There was like planting of evidence. There was framing of people. We'll get to that. There was framing of people. There were like things that you can't even imagine would be possible in America. And then you see, like you said, with the systemic racism, you see the racial profiling and mm-hmm. all these things that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so what ends up happening now is people start to believe that New York is safe now. So now they're going to go in and gentrify it and turn it into the suburban place that it is now.
Right.
But that never really, like they never really actually addressed the crime. And there were even people who were getting away with rape and other things because they were so focused on all this minutia and wasting time trying to come up with people to arrest that they weren't actually doing their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just an interesting case study, I think.
Well, and it is. And that's a lot about when I talked about the power of investigation, mm-hmm. right? They were investigating all this crap
right.
that they could have just let slide, and people were getting away with murder.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so that's a lot of what.
Yeah, the morale is poor.
Yeah, I mean, so many. And it's like we said, you know, we picked it apart.
Right.
We picked it apart into these little tiny pieces. But these little tiny pieces, there's never just one piece.
Right.
There's always pieces.
Right.
Several pieces.
Yeah.
And they all come together to make this big mess that we're seeing now.
I feel like I'm a statistical anomaly because I did turn to substances at a young age to deal with my trauma.
Sure.
So I'll admit that. And I definitely have mental health challenges because of that trauma, but I'm dealing with it and I'm seeing a therapist and all that stuff. But, you know, I could have easily turned to a life of crime. I could have easily become a domestic abuser.
Absolutely.
If I wouldn't have had people in my life who loved me and mentored me and took care of me and showed me that there was another way to live. If I wouldn't have had that, I could easily have become this. And so I think that the weight of childhood trauma and domestic violence and child abuse in relation to crime is often overlooked and most of the time understated.
I absolutely agree, because we don't really talk about that, do right. we? We don't talk about how much domestic violence goes on, and we don't talk about right. how much child abuse goes on. Those things are kind of pushed to the background, but they're the most important part of what the future is.
Yeah.
I think that between that and gang violence,
right.
the, you know, the familial violence and the gang violence, those are the two things that are driving the crime of the future.
Right.
And they're, honestly, if you look, if anybody cares to come to Albuquerque, we'll give you the grand tour.
You'll get some good food.
Oh, you'll get some really good food.
But your car will probably get stolen.
Probably. And then there's always the chance that you may get shot.
You could get mugged.
You could get mugged.
We don't know.
We don't know. We don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, they find bodies in the streets.
Good
right?
food, though.
Good food. Oh, excellent food.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You will love the food.
Well, I can't lose weight. All right, we've got a question here from Rena. She says, what countries do a good job with rehabilitation / incarceration dilemma?
Okay, so the ones that actually do the best are Sweden.
Nordic.
What?
Nordic countries.
Yeah, absolutely. Sweden, yeah. Denmark, and Finland.
Yeah.
They're the ones that are really, they have sort of, they've got their shit together in so many ways. They mm-hmm. have the best healthcare there.
Education.
The best education there. The best criminal rehabilitation there.
Maternity, paternity leave.
I mean, all of those things.
Yeah.
And it's all, and all of that contributes to why there's such a very, very low crime rate there. They have very little abuse. They have an excellent healthcare system, which that means that mental health is actually sure. being addressed. You know, it's not just being shoved aside
right.
and left until you're out on the streets living in a tent.
I saw a documentary. I think it was about, it might have been Denmark. It's either Denmark or Sweden. I don't remember. I think it was Denmark. And it was a, like, you've probably seen those documentaries or kind of docuseries about prison life in America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty grim.
Pretty rough.
To watch the life that these people live. And the violence that happens just in the prison. Mm-hmm. Well, this, I don't remember what it was, but this documentary went into one of those Scandinavian prisons. I think it was Denmark. And it is unlike any prison. Like, it's not even a prison. It was almost like a hotel. It was kind of, at first I was a little bit like, is this great? I don't think this is so great.
It's supposed to be punishment, right?
Yeah. But I mean, one of the guys, I mean, it wasn't a big room, but most places in Europe aren't that big anyway.
Right.
But it was a room, and there was a bed. There was carpeting.
Wow.
There were bookshelves and books.
Oh my gosh.
He had so much stuff throughout his, like, it was one prisoner they were following, and this guy had so much stuff throughout his day. Like, he had classes in the morning, he had exercise in the afternoon. You know, he was able to have family come in and spend time with him.
So he had structure.
He had structure.
He had support.
Yep.
He had probably
a therapy.
Good therapy. Mm-hmm. He had all of these. I mean, that's a really good support system.
Yeah.
And that would promote rehabilitation.
Right.
But just setting them into a
Stanford prison experiment or the rat
a cage.
Experiment.
Yeah, just putting people in a cage doesn't right. rehabilitate.
Right. I think, too, like, that is all kind of after the fact. I think to your point, Jackie, you kind of have to get it when, like, the kids are getting involved in that or being exposed to that kind of stuff, right? Like, you have to deal with it then.
I am super proactive.
Yeah.
I like to get things before they happen.
But our governments are not.
Oh, no, our governments are not. Well, right. and in fact, our government is the one that kind of took all those things away, right?
Right.
I mean,
in the 80s.
When you think about the 80s.
In the 70s,
yeah. And Reagan wanted to save money.
Right.
So
austerity.
Yeah. He shut down all the state hospitals. And what he did was he implemented HIPAA laws.
Right.
So that that would kind of cover things. He said the state hospitals were violating people's HIPAA laws.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And defunded all of them.
And he defunded all of them.
Yeah.
And now here we are 40, however many.
We're still dealing with the aftermath of that.
Well, we're dealing with generations
of aftermath.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we're dealing with two generations of aftermath. And the problem just got bigger, right?
Well, and there's more people now, too.
Yeah. I mean, the original people that were in those hospitals that they let go,
right,
they procreated
right
over two generations.
Right.
And now we have more people with those same problems because a lot of those problems are genetic.
Right. I think everybody wants there to be like a magic pill you can take to get rid of crime, and there just isn't. It would take mm-hmm. I would say it would take probably 50 years of proactive
reconstruction
absolute, but also reconstruction. Like just proactive intervention
mm-hmm.
In every community, and that the cost of that is staggering.
It would be exorbitant,
but you know that investment in the future is what it would take to deal with this.
And
looking at how we treat people who are incarcerated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if you're being treated like garbage every day, you're not really going to be motivated to be a good exemplary citizen when you get out.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Do we have other questions from the audience? Also, we've got some topic starters here. So
yeah,
we've talked about poverty and homelessness.
Yeah, this is just like, okay, if we want to expand.
Yeah. So, I'm just looking to see where I want to go now. Gosh, these are all just such really clear insight into the actual causes of crime and crime being the symptom. Like there's so many tendrils that just go out into society.
Well, and I think that that's something that people don't understand is that we can't do one little thing.
Right.
One little magic wand isn't going to solve this.
No.
Okay. We have to start investing in people.
Right.
And we have to get them engaged, and we have to get them support, and we have to get them education, and we have to do all of these things to make this problem go away.
I also think that our society is so individualistic and so focused on getting what you want when you want it. Doesn't matter at what cost that is.
Right.
Or
if it hurts somebody
else. Well, yeah. Or if it hurts, yeah. Which is what I meant by cost.
Yeah.
Right. It doesn't matter what the cost is.
Right.
That is kind of ingrained in us as Americans. And if there are non-Americans watching, you can probably see that from the outside looking in, but that is kind of, it's like every man for himself. And I think that is another part of the problem, because if there were going to be somebody who ran for office who said, okay, we're going to deal with this, and we're going to create, you know, resources for people who have been child abused, you know, child sexual abuse, we're going to create resources that will help a battered partner get back on their feet.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to create resources that are going to intervene with kids at a young age so that they aren't attracted by gangs.
We're going to create resources that help people with mental health problems.
Right. We're going to create resources that are going to fund the cops in a way and train them in a way that they won't be, you know, burnt out and dealing with all the stuff that they're dealing
with.
And pay them. Yeah. You know. We're going to pay Child Protective Services
a decent wage
and we're not going to overwork them.
Right.
Right. These are the things that it's going to take
mm-hmm.
to deal with crime in a meaningful way. Yeah. You can temporarily bring crime down by just locking everybody up temporarily, but that's not going to last. It's not sustainable because it doesn't deal with the actual causes.
And the other thing is like a lot of the things that we're looking at right now that are supposed to cure crime is like putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound.
100%.
You know, it's not going to work because you have too many things going on.
Right.
You have to fix it all. And maybe not fix it all at one time.
Right.
But let's try dealing with some people's mental health. I mean,
it would be a good decade before you saw the results of anything.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. If not longer.
Right.
You know.
Which is why it's not popular to fix crime.
Exactly.
It's cheaper.
It's cheaper.
And it's less work to just let it be. Mm-hmm. And then promise to do things that are going to fix it.
Yeah. And none of the solutions by themselves. There are solutions that you hear of.
Yeah.
And there are things that, you know, they've kind of talked about.
Right.
But one solution isn't going to fix it.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So we're just the bummer people.
Well,
letting you know that there's no hope.
It's 100 seconds to midnight.
We're going to be stuck with this forever. And we're all going to die.
And we're all going to die.
But not before our cars are stolen.
Well, you know, that's something that just happens.
Also, yeah. I thought I was a bummer, and then I started listening to your show, and God, you're a worse bummer than me.
I'm horrifying, aren't I?
Oh, God.
I'm terrifying.
If you're not listening to Jackie's show, you will learn a lot about things that you don't want to know about, and it'll give you nightmares, but it's really well done.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
I tried to play her promo earlier and it wasn't working. So I'm going to play it really quick. Give you guys some time to chat some questions in there. And then we're going to come back and talk a little bit about a case we are working on now. And we might even talk a little bit about a case that we recently covered. But if you have questions, we're going to answer all of those. Just stay tuned. Listen to Jackie's promo. We will be right back. Once I get my life together.
Did you know that the AIDS pandemic almost wiped out an entire generation of a culture? Did you know that politics drive the way we handle pandemics? Did you know that more people died of smallpox than war-related injuries in the Revolutionary and Civil Wars? Do you have questions about the opioid crisis? How socioeconomics fuel healthcare? Wonder why the cost of drugs is so high? I'm Jackie Maranti, and I host a podcast called Cause of Death. This show explores all of these questions and many more. If you haven't listened to my podcast, you should. Cause of Death can be found wherever you listen to podcasts. Our history is here to teach us lessons, but as you'll find out, we rarely learn our lessons. So I do want to address one more elephant in the room.
Okay.
Today is National Gun Violence Day. And we've seen a huge uptake in
mass shootings. Yeah.
And so I want to touch on that. I don't want to get into a big gun debate, though, because that's not what we're here for.
Right.
Okay. But I do want to talk about something that I have a personal connection to, which was the Aurora Theater shooting. Mm. Someone that I worked with at the time was killed by James Holmes. And I want to talk a little bit about James Holmes and what happened before the shooting and what happened after the shooting. And where he landed. And I know that, you know, right now it's not the cool thing to do to talk about the murderer. We always want to honor the victims, but it's important that we talk about James Holmes
for
just a minute.
Okay.
James Holmes was an absolute genius. He was a scientific genius. And when he was 11 years old, he put a very complicated science project into the science fair, won the science fair, went home and immediately tried to commit suicide. Hmm. So this kid had problems long before the shooting. He had some pretty severe mental problems his whole entire life. He battled depression, bipolar. I believe schizophrenia was another diagnosis they gave him. So by the time that he was 23 years old, 24 years old, he was going to University of Colorado, and he was a contender for his doctorate degree in neuroscience. He was under an extreme amount of stress. He wasn't doing very well. He had withdrawn from all of his classes before he could fail, which is what you do, right? And he was seeing two therapists and a social worker.
Wow.
To talk about, you know, what was going on in his life. He had gone to all three of these people and several of his friends outside of school and told them that he felt like he was going to do something bad. And nobody said anything. Two therapists and a social worker, and they didn't say anything. And the reason was because he didn't say enough to make it sound like a threat.
Wow.
All he said was, I feel like I'm going to do something bad. So if they would have said something at that point, it would have been a violation of his HIPAA laws.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So a few days after he went into the theater, and he had been planning this for at least a year ahead of time. He'd been planning this for a long, long time. This wasn't something where he woke up on Saturday and just decided to go and shoot a bunch of people. So he just decided that that was the day, though. He had stockpiled 6,000 rounds of ammunition, two AR-15s, several handguns, and he had wired his apartment building with enough explosives to blow up two city blocks.
Wow.
So he wasn't just intending on shooting people, and he would later tell psychiatrists this after he was caught and behind bars. He would later tell them that he didn't care how he killed people. He just wanted to take out as many people as he could. Okay. So needless to say, he went into the theater, he chalked the door open so he could get back out without raising any alarms, and he shot. There's varying numbers of how many people he shot. 12 people died, and one of them was my friend.
Mm.
And I followed that. I followed it all the way through. I followed the trial. I followed everything. And I watched it until I couldn't watch it anymore. Basically, I waited until James Holmes was actually sentenced. And he was sentenced to 3,318 years behind bars on 165 counts. And some of those counts were terrorism because of the bombs that he had put in his apartment. There were two city blocks evacuated for 2 days to try and clear that out without blowing anything up.
Wow.
Now, going back to the next part of this, a few days after he was sentenced, I walked into the break room at CSU and I sat down and somebody was sitting across from me and the newspaper was laying out on the table. And above the fold, there was a picture of James Holmes with his crazy eyes and his orange hair and, you know, looking all nuts and stuff. And below the fold, there was a sale at Dillard's on Prada shoes. And I tell Eric this story. Well, I don't think I've told you the whole story, but the gal across from me looked at the newspaper and she said, "Oh, look, Dillard's is having a sale on Prada." And that's when I knew that things were just going to go back to normal. We were going to just move on with our lives and nothing was going to get done about mass shootings. And I I think I've said it a few times now, as we've talked about some of the mass shootings that are going on currently. I said, well, just wait, Pride will have a shoe sale and it'll all be forgotten.
It's true, though. And I think it it all kind of comes back to
the apathy.
The apathy, but also the idea that the solution for this is not simple.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I think it takes a lot of different things. I mean, I think definitely some common sense regulations on firearms.
Absolutely.
You know, it. Mm-hmm. There needs to be some kind of line that we draw where we say, you know, understanding that there are illegal ways to get weapons, understanding that, but also understanding that this kind of thing doesn't happen really hardly anywhere else as much as it happens here.
Mm-hmm. And you know, let's go back when we were talking about the Nordic countries, look at how much support they have, right? It's very, very hard to get a gun there.
Right.
You can, because people still have a sports shooting events. You know, they go clay shooting,
they go hunting.
Yeah. They do whatever. Even targets.
Right.
You know, so you can get a gun there, but what it takes is a way, way, way more
stringent,
intense background check than what we have. And we need that.
Right.
And we also need a whole lot better mental health care.
Absolutely.
I mean, those two things.
Both of those things can be true at the same time.
They can be true at the same time. And I absolutely agree that, you know, our gun laws are pretty lax. I mean,
that's an understatement.
But I don't even know how to say, you know.
It's the same thing, though, I think, with crime, with domestic violence, with child abuse. Mm-hmm. We've become somewhat numb to it. And I saw this happen in New Mexico with all of the child abuse cases and child murder cases that were coming through, where people get mad for a minute.
And then
they're enraged. They're marching in the streets. They're yelling. And then something happens.
Prada has a shoe sale.
It's not even, it doesn't even have to be that. It could just be, you know, anything. Literally anything could be a distraction. And so what happens is you forget. Right. We forget because we're just inundated with information all the time and things are changing constantly. Mm-hmm. And so it's really hard until we're all willing to like stand up to our representatives and say, look, you're damaging the lives of your community and your constituents. And you obviously don't care that all of us are dying. So we're going to say goodbye to you and we're going to bring somebody else in.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
That's part of it.
But when you have people who can be career senators and representatives and can basically live out their whole adulthood in that, they really have no incentive, and they're making millions of dollars a year.
Oh, absolutely.
They have no incentive,
to do anything. And
yeah,
it doesn't matter which side of the aisle you're on.
It's the same.
Yeah. They're one's just as corrupt as the other.
They're all the same.
They're all the same.
We are just bummers tonight.
We are.
All right. Can we move on to, because we only have like 20 more minutes. Can we move on to some more other topics?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. I'm not saying.
Yeah. No. That was good. It's a good conversation to have. I think it's important that we talk about this. I think it's important that we talk about this respectfully with each other instead of screaming at each other all the time. Because that's the only way we're going to be able to do this or do anything about this is to work together.
And the other thing I'd like to say is that people really need to be careful with their social media.
Yeah.
Because you don't know who's watching.
Right.
There are people out there who have been victimized and they have Facebook too.
Right.
And so be careful. Be kind.
Be kind. Choose kindness.
Choose kindness.
All right. Okay. So, project we're working on right now. And again, if you guys have questions, the four of you that are still with us here, if you have questions or you want to contribute to the conversation, please, it just feels like we're talking to ourselves. So throw some words in there for us so we don't feel like we're talking to ourselves or that you guys are asleep and not paying attention anymore. Okay. So something that people who aren't patrons and aren't following my social media may not know is that we just completed production on a story that I've wanted to talk about for a long time. You wanted to talk about for a while as well. And it's something that's continuing to happen. It's not in New Mexico. So this was kind of a big departure. It's not even in the United States for true consequences, but there is connections.
Yeah, there's connections.
We can get to that. Yeah. So I forgot what I was saying now. Dang you, Jackie.
Sorry.
So we went.
It's all my fault. It's always my fault.
So we went south of the border to talk about the women of Juarez, the La Desaparecidas, which means the missing women in Juarez. And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of women who have been, who have vanished, who have been murdered, whose some have had their remains found, some have not. It is a crazy, terrifying story. And it's going to be coming out, I think, in the next 2 to 3 weeks, just depending on how the interviews with attorney general candidates work out. Probably 2 weeks is my thought. But I want to talk a little bit about that, Jackie, about that case. And then just to give a kind of a preview to the people who are here, because sure. they bought mm-hmm. tickets to be here.
Yeah.
And so they deserve to get a little peek under the tent.
Hey, you know what? I'm good with that.
All right, Jackie. So let's talk about it. So I asked you to take this project on. Mm-hmm. You know, I had some say in some of it, but really I just let you kind of run with it.
Pretty much.
So let's talk about how that went with research and writing.
So research on this was insane. Mm-hmm. I could not, I mean, you know, I can't ask Mexico for FOIA requests.
Right.
They're not going to give me anything. You right. know, so I had to rely a lot on newspapers. Several books have been written about mm-hmm. it. I actually had one translated from Spanish so I could read through it. Two documentaries. It took me forever to wade through all of this.
Right.
And then it took me forever to figure out how to tell this story because it's so heartbreaking.
And it spans decades.
They're not even sure that the first bodies were the ones that were found in 1993. They think that this may have gone back all the way to the 70s, mm-hmm. late 70s, early 80s. And thousands of women
right.
are still missing and go missing every day in Mexico. So through all of that, I figured out kind of how to tell the story, and I could only pick a few victims.
Right.
There's no way. There's just so many. So I had to kind of cherry pick my victims, and I picked the ones that I felt had, they had a definite connection to one another mm-hmm. so that the story was easier to tell. And I also felt that they were the ones that sort of got me the most. Mm. You know, I had that gotcha moment. And it was like, oh yeah, we got to talk about her because there's just something about her that makes you wonder what was going on.
Right.
And a lot of it had to do with corruption.
Right.
A lot of this had to do with gang affiliations, cartels.
Drug cartels, yeah.
People were being threatened anytime they talked about it. The police were probably involved, even though no one could prove that.
There's definitely some wealthy people involved.
There were some. Yes, definitely wealthy people involved. And a lot of it was surrounded by the NAFTA agreement and the maquiladoras that were the factories
yep.
along the border.
Yep.
And so much went into this and so much happened during those times that it was almost overwhelming.
Yeah.
It
was overwhelming.
It was pretty gut-wrenching.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you look at the staggering number of women and girls who've just disappeared, lost their lives, it's just even recording those episodes was really tough emotionally. And just to think about the scope of that and how long it's been going on without anything meaningful happening, without actually, and I won't spoil anything, but without actually like understanding the whole scope of what it is. I mean, it's possible that there were people who were serial killers in the US who were abducting people here, you know, in border states and taking them down there and dumping their bodies. That's a possibility, but there's no proof.
There's nothing. Yeah.
Of any of that.
Yeah. Cause I told you, I texted Eric one night and I was like, oh my God, I think I found David Ray Parker.
Parker Ray.
Yeah. David Parker Ray.
Toy box killer.
I think I found his means, and there were mentions of it. There were rumors about it. And I kept chasing these rumors and I never could quite say that he was involved in it.
Well, and even Jesse Ray told one of the victims, I think it was the other woman who survived. I forgot what her name is, but she told her that my dad can make you disappear. He can take you to Mexico and make you disappear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they have never found any of the bodies here. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how much I can say. I don't want to spoil it. No, you know, don't. I'm like, I do that. So there's all kinds of things going on with this. And it was just horrifying. And it took, how long did it take me to write that?
Oh, a couple months.
Yeah. It took me to write.
That doesn't include the research that you did before that, though.
Yeah. And then I was like, well, and how long do you want this to be? How many episodes do you want? Yeah.
So there are two episodes right now on Patreon. So if you're a patron, you can watch or listen to those right now. The third one should be up, hopefully, if I can get the editing done this weekend. It should be up by the end of this weekend or beginning of next week. It's a three-part series, so it's not quite as long as the Dylan Redwine series that we worked on together. There was no way I would have had you write it yourself if it was that long. We would have split it up, but and then Dylan Redwine was like a whole other thing that it feels like it's so far and so long ago.
Oh, I know, doesn't it?
But there's still people listening right now, and that story was heartbreaking as well.
Oh, that was awful.
We've got about 10 minutes left. So does anybody have any questions? Don't have to be about epidemiology of crime. Doesn't have to be about anything. It could be about whatever you want, but we would love to just chat with you in the last few minutes here. If you want to chat with us, or are you just going to stare at us?
We can stare back.
All right.
So do we want to talk a little bit about Dylan, and then just before we go, I'll tell everyone about my show a little bit.
Yeah. We can talk. I mean, I really wish that you guys would say something.
Yeah.
Are you there?
Hello? Can you hear us?
I'm really tired of hearing us talk. Even though I can't hear you, I want to see what you're saying. So say something. Dylan. So if you haven't listened or watched the series yet, definitely encourage you to do that. Any similarities to the disappeared women found on the Mesa?
Yes, there were some similarities between those two cases. There was just no way to connect them.
I would say this, sure. I don't know that they're connected. In fact, I would say the similarities are in the fact that law enforcement believes, and I think some people in law enforcement and WADIS believe, that there are a lot of people who are wealthy and in power that are doing this kind of thing.
Yes.
Which is kind of the theory that's happening and floating around right now here.
With the Mesa killings.
Yeah. But that's not to say that there aren't serial killers involved in both of those situations, right?
Yeah. You know, and really, I mean, you can't say that there's any kind of connection, but there are several similarities. And so, yes, I mean, who knows what?
It could be a mix of things,
yeah. A ton of stuff.
It definitely is in the women of WADIS. It definitely is a mix of things in the women of WADIS.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But you know, with the West Mesa, there's just not a lot of information out there.
And that's the hard part, is that we just don't really know.
Right.
If you could kind of figure out what even happened out there, or get any kind of clue about what happened out there, then maybe you could come up with even an answer for that on its own.
And for those of you not from Albuquerque or New Mexico, so the West Mesa murders was in the west side of Albuquerque. A mesa is a flat kind of hilltop that looks like a table, which is why it's called a mesa, which means table in Spanish, which is on the west side of Albuquerque. And for a long time in the 80s and 90s and before that, it was just open desert. And then Albuquerque started to grow and they started developing houses out there. And that's when somebody who was just going for a jog in their neighborhood
with their dog
mm-hmm. ran into a leg bone.
Yeah, the dog went and found the leg bone and brought it back.
And she was a nurse and she recognized that it was human.
She recognized that it was a human bone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what started that whole thing. Could they be connected? Maybe.
Maybe.
But again,
there's just no way to
prove it.
There's no way to prove it. There's no way to tell. There's no way to prove it.
Yeah. And it's just staggering. Mm. Okay. We have another one here. We have, how can we as regular people get involved and make a difference? I have thoughts, so I'm going to go, and then you can go after me if you have thoughts.
That's fine.
So I think that one of the biggest things that you can do is to, first of all, care. That's a huge thing, right? So if you, like Jackie said, if you see something, say something, even if it is nothing. The worst that can happen is they investigate it and it's nothing and everyone's fine. The best that can happen is something is happening and somebody can get help when they need it. So that's one thing is don't be a standby person. Don't be a looker on. Be somebody who says something's off here and I don't care if I look stupid by calling this in.
Yeah,
I don't care what I look like. Mm-hmm. I'm going to feel better knowing that this is a safer situation either way. Right. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is something I always talk about, which is if you care about victims, but you also like true crime, listen to the shows and watch the shows that treat the victims with respect, that don't sensationalize, that don't speculate, that provide facts and information to the best of their ability. Those are the kinds of things that I think make an impact, because then you get those cases out into more ears.
And you get the correct information.
Get the correct information. And it just changes how we look at this, right? The other thing is, you know, look for the organizations that are doing the things that we're talking about, you know, which organizations are intervening in youth gang intervention or child abuse, trauma, healing, intervention, those kinds of things. Donate to those organizations.
Or volunteer
at those organizations. Mm-hmm. Those things will go a long way, because we're definitely not going to count on our government to fix these problems for us, because they're not going to.
They're not going to.
They can't. Right.
Right.
Your thoughts on what an everyday person can do.
So I think Eric made some really, really good points, and especially about getting involved in your own communities. I think community involvement can go a long, long way. You know, when I talked about the communities that fall apart because people are too afraid to come out and get involved in their communities, mm-hmm. try and get involved with things that you don't, you know, any kind of community organization, try and volunteer.
Yeah.
Another thing is talk about this.
Yeah.
Talk about this like big people, though. Use your words. talk about this without saying, and this is the one thing we can do.
Right.
You know, we've just talked about how many things need to change. Talk about all of them.
Yeah.
You know, make it a mission to get that idea out there. And maybe if the idea hits the right people, we might get something done.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Ellen was amazed at what we said about gangs. So what part was amazing? I've lived in Albuquerque from 99 to 2005 and had very little idea about crime. Yeah, I think it was a little bit safer back then. The no bond law came into effect in 2014. And that's when we really started to see some problems. I mean, there was some stuff happening in the early 2000s and late 90s, and we were dealing with laws that were trying to mitigate overcrowding in the jails. But I don't think it was as bad as it is now, first of all. Secondarily, I think the internet and social media have kind of amplified problems that we have in the world. Like, we can see them more, we can see them more quickly. It's kind of in our palms, you know, all the time. So I think we're more aware just because we're bombarded with information right now. I don't think that necessarily, I mean, yeah, it is worse, but there was still crime back then.
There was still crime back then, but proportionate to now, in the last 5 years, the crime rate has almost doubled.
Oh, so she's talking about gangs in the Torreon cabin murders.
Oh, okay.
And how we talked about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think that they were as heavily affiliated as but there was a lot of gang
connection there. Yeah.
Activity and connection there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just don't think that they were, because gangs now are little businesses.
Oh yeah.
They're little businesses. They're making quite a bit of money.
Sure.
And so back then, I think that gang kind of had a different feel to it.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite as,
it was a loose association.
Yeah.
That did crime together and beat each other up.
Yeah. And even though the gang that those guys were involved in, they did have like affiliations out of state. They had affiliations in California, things like that. But I don't think that it meant the same thing that it does now. Now, God, they're pretty darn close to the mafia.
Okay, Jackie, you have 30 seconds to tell people about your show.
Okay. So I'm Jackie Maranti, and I do a podcast called Cause of Death, 100 Seconds to Midnight. And I talk about all of the things that will kill you that aren't true crime. I talk about world pandemics. I talk about society. I talk about epidemiology. I talk about the world water crisis, all of these things that make the doomsday clock tick down. The doomsday clock has been set at 100 seconds to midnight since 2020. And several factors go into that, and what we can do to stop it, or how we can watch it tick.
Watch the world burn.
Watch the world burn.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thanks for buying a ticket to see us tonight. I hope it was worth your time. I hope you learned something. I hope you felt something, and I hope you stay safe, New Mexico.
Night.
Bye.